Please welcome our speaker tonight. His name is Jim Kay from Manhattan, New York.
My name is Jim Kelly. I'm an alcoholic. Oh boy, I could haul out and fill up. I don't know if I can do it. I want to thank this group for having me out tonight to speak. It's always a pleasure to speak for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I see my friends out in the audience. I was told I had groupies coming here tonight, so that was pretty funny. It's posted on my Facebook page. But I'm a member of the Interaction Group. We meet on Wednesday night at 6:30 p.m. We have a big book step study. And we meet in an old Vanderbilt mansion with gilded ceilings and tapestries. It's really one of the nicest rooms I've been to in an AA group. And I've been happy there for the past 15 years in that group. My sobriety date's from August 8th of 1980. And I'm a satisfied customer of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, standing up here trying to carry a message that, you know, carries both weight and depth is, you know, a big burden to carry sometimes. And what happens to me sometimes is I get overwhelmed with emotion. Just like now. Because I'm so grateful. But I have a great sponsor. His name is Bill. And Bill is sober 43 years, and he got sober when I was 6 years old. And Bill likes to play golf, but he's 80 years old, and, you know, so we go, we'll maybe go play the par three, and I'll have to say that Bill is a better sponsor than he is a golfer. You know, so he'll get up to the tee box, and he'll swing away, and more often than not, everybody's got a duck. And so one day he hits the ball over by the water hazard. And so I go over and help him to go find his ball. And I see him bend over and I see him pick something up, but it's not his ball. So I go over there and he's got this frog in his hand. And he's looking at the frog, and the frog says to him, "If you let me go, I will grant you all the sexual favors and all that you could possibly have in your life. Every woman you ever wanted, you'll have." And Bill looks at the frog and he sticks it in his pocket. I said, "Bill, why did you put the frog in your pocket?" He says, "It's more important to me to have a talking frog than to have all that sex." My sponsor's a great guy. He's been a power of example to me for a long time. You know, I'm a third-generation member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My grandfather came into AA in the 1960s. My mother came in 1971. And you know, I'm grateful to be in AA. And because they blazed the path, I came in as young as I did. You know, August 8th of 1980, I was 17 years old. And I did not have to go back out and find out exactly what I already knew, and that is I'm an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. And, you know, I was not the kind of guy who drank socially, ever. I drank for effect from the very beginning. I drank because of the way it made me feel. And the way I felt most of my life was out of place, like a round peg in a square hole, like I didn't belong somehow. I kind of like had to pinch myself, like, am I really alive? I mean, it just seemed so surreal to me. And when I drank, you know, the first taste of alcohol was the gin-soaked olives out of my mother's martinis when I was a child, which I remembered. And we had this plant in the living room that she would, you know, pour drinks into when she got tired of them. That plant died when she came to Alcoholics Anonymous because it was forced to stop drinking. And I guess I was 8 years old when my mom came into AA, and she would bring me to meetings. And the very first meeting that she brought me to was at the Sobriety Unlimited group in Mount Vernon. And I was about 8 or 9 years old, and she brought me to the meeting, and she said, "Sit down, shut up, don't say a thing, don't touch anything, you know, just be here." And I guess it was like July or August, and I sat through the meeting with her. And, in the room, they had a Christmas tree, fully decorated, in July. So I said to my mother, well, why do they have a Christmas tree in July in this room? And she said, these people believe that sobriety is a gift, and that every day is Christmas. We should be grateful for sobriety each day, as if it was Christmas. And I never forgot that. That was a long time ago. I picked up my first drink in earnest was my mother divorced my father in 1971 when she came into AA. And I picked up my first drink in 1974 at the wedding that she had to my stepfather. Now, while she was going to meetings, all of us would be, we would have babysitters. And when she decided to get married, I ended up sitting at the table with all the babysitters. So they thought it would be a great idea to feed this kid Tom Collins's. Well, I enjoyed Tom Collins's. I enjoyed myself. I danced. I had a great time. I really, it was like the missing link was there. I felt comfortable for once. I asked girls to dance. I mean, it was an amazing thing. My mom and my stepfather went out to Montauk to go on their honeymoon. I slept on my dad's couch. I also peed all over my dad's couch. And it was a complete alcohol experience. I had a headache the next day, but I was dying to do it again one more time. And any opportunity I had to pick up a drink, I would. Which wasn't easy. I mean, I was in a AA household. There's not much drinking going on there. But every chance I got, I would go out and I would drink. And, my typical drinking situation would be I'd be going out with my friends. We'd find somebody who looked old enough to buy something for us. And I made sure I had mine and as much of yours as I could get my hands on. That was exactly the way I drank. It was about me, 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 me. And that should have tipped me off. And I would go to anniversaries with my mother. Back then you could smoke in AA rooms and there'd be this fog that was like everywhere. I mean, there was only clear air down this below the floor. And, my eyes would be burning, but, everybody would come out of that place smiling, And I'd listen to the speakers and say how wonderful it is for them, but that has nothing to do with me. They're really great experiences. We had AA people in and out of our apartment all the time. My mother sponsored a lot of people. I was, exposed to AA most of the time. But I thought I was smarter than the average bear. I thought I can get over on everyone, one way or the other. And, I didn't have anybody fooled, but I thought I did. My drinking really, took off when I was in high school. And I learned that the emergency card they sent home at the beginning of the year was the card that they compared the signature on the absent notes on. So when the emergency card went home, I signed the card, and I brought it back to school. So I cut school a lot, and I used to write all the notes, and they compare the notes, and they never call home because I always had a note. I ended up going to maybe half of my high school classes, if that, and I would spend most of my time drinking every weekend. Like most alcoholics, I guess, I dabbled in drugs. But, my primary purpose was to drink. That's where it was at. Because I still never felt comfortable, no matter what, unless I was drinking. And once I put the first drink in, I never knew what I was going to end up doing. When I turned 16, I got my driver's license 3 weeks after I turned 16. I bought my parents' car from them. I was very industrious. I would work so I could have the money I needed to drink and carouse or whatever else I was doing. I did pretty well in school. I guess I carried about a B average. And my senior year came. And in my senior year, I had to take 3 classes to graduate. So that's all I took was 3 classes. I mean, why take any more? And I grouped my classes so that there were between 9 and 12. And there was a reason for it, because my mother, who was an alcoholism counselor at the time, would leave for work. I wouldn't have to go to school until after she left, so I would wait till the school called, say, I'm sick, then go to school and hang out with everybody and get drunk. Then at 1 o'clock, I would go to my job. And back then, I was working from 1 p.m. to 9 p.m. in a nursing home, making pretty good money back then. And then we'd all go to the bar afterwards. And night after night, I would get home. I wouldn't know how I got there. I thought blackouts were just part of the deal. And, you know, I backed myself into a corner during my senior year of high school where I had to pass the physics regents exam with an 86 or better in order to graduate. I mean, who does that? This alcoholic. I would go to great lengths to protect my drinking, no matter what. And so I stopped drinking for a week. I studied the entire course. I passed the test with a 91, graduated from high school by the skin of my teeth. And I was destined to a career of drinking, at least. That's how I set myself up. I was going to go to school at a little town called Oswego on Lake Ontario. And SUNY Oswego has a thing called the Bridge Street Run. And the idea is you start on the east end of town and you drink your way back to campus along Bridge Street. And I thought, well, that's a great idea. I think I'll do that. So I spent the whole summer drinking and everything else and having car accidents and not knowing what the hell I hit. Thinking twice about it. First week of August rolled around. And my mom and my stepfather were on Long Island vacationing. My brother and sister away at camp. And I was by myself in this apartment. So I threw parties. I stayed drunk the entire week. And long before CSI was around, I was able to cover my tracks pretty well, so nobody knew what went on. I mean, the carpets were shampooed, everything was cleaned out. You never knew. It was cleaner than they left. Again, I thought that had them fooled. But when my mom and my stepfather came back, they said, you know, you've been coming home late. You better get home early. Enough of this stuff. Okay, so I go to a pool party about 20 miles to the north up in Putnam County. And as usual, I was the first guy there. Now, the party starts at 8. I show up at 6 o'clock. You know, of course, you know, I'm going to get the keg tapped and make it run smooth. Of course, I'm drunk before the party even starts. And it was a hot August night. It was 90 degrees, hot as hell, and I did not get in the pool once. I hung around the keg the whole time. Typical, you know, that was me. And around 11:30, I knew it was time to get going, and so I started driving back to Yorktown. And I got within about 2 miles of the house when I passed out at the wheel, and I hit a telephone pole doing about 50 miles an hour. And I totaled out the car, and the telephone pole was laying in the street, and I didn't have a scratch on me. I don't know why or how. And that was the aha moment. That was the point at which I was able to connect my trouble with my drinking. And up until that time, I was not capable of doing that. It was always some other reason for what befell me, and at this time, it was because I was out drinking. So, lights went on in the house across the street. I go over and ask to use the phone, and call my mother up, and I said, I've been out drinking, I wrecked the car, and I think I ought to go to AA. And, you know, yelling, screaming, cursing, and everything else coming from the other end of the phone. I tell her where I am. My stepfather comes to get me. And back then, they weren't giving out DWIs like they're giving out candy. The cops said, go sit in your father's car. We'll take care of this. And that was pretty much the end of it from the police. But going home was worse. I didn't want to go home. My mother was a very strict German woman, and I was not about to cross her. And I knew what was waiting for me when I got home. And when I got home, I got verbally assaulted. And then I passed out in bed. And the next morning, I think it was early afternoon, I woke up. And my mind was telling me that I was too young, that I made a couple mistakes, and be different next time. And right then, my mother walked in the room with a list of names and numbers of people who I knew from, you know, being family friends. And she said, if you want to go to AA, I'm not going to be your taxi service. You better make a phone call and ask somebody to come pick you up. And I called one of the names, one of the guys on that list. He came, picked me up, and he brought me to the Bedford Village Group. The Bedford Village Group meets in the same town as Stepping Stones, where Bill and Lois lived in Westchester County. And it was a Sunday night, and it was an open meeting, very much like this. room full of people. I walked in, and they've jumped on me like I was fresh meat. The white, pasty complexion, the Fu Manchu mustache. I look like a Puerto Rican terrorist. Like I hadn't seen light in I don't know how long. And they figured out I was new to AA. And those two guys, a guy named Mike B., who's been long dead, and another guy named Jimmy the Hat. And Jimmy the Hat. I never saw him wear a hat, but they call him Jimmy the Hat. They taught me how to identify with speakers. Now, you used to hear in the rooms of AA a lot, try to identify, don't compare. And what they wanted to do was help me to include myself in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because we come from all different walks of life. I mean, I look around the room, there's people from all different segments of society here tonight. And it's very easy for us to say, well, I don't have anything in common with these people. I really don't need this, and walk out. And fortunately, those guys grabbed me and said, you know, you may have drank under different circumstances and in different places, but there are things that all of us alcoholics seem to have in common. Maybe you should try to latch on to those. The fear, the low self-esteem, the remorse, the guilt, you know, all the fun things that go with alcoholism. And, you know, I said I listened to people who were probably in their 50s who drank in very different places, and I identified. I felt like I was in the right place. Jimmy the Hat became my first sponsor. I joined his group. The Crow Hill group met in Mount Kisco in Westchester, and I met three nights a week. And he said, well, if you're going to ask me to be, you know, your sponsor, you have to join my group. So I joined the group, and he told me I was too sick to comprehend the 12 and 12, that the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous has the message of how to get well in Alcoholics Anonymous, that all the answers are contained within the first 164 pages and the doctor's opinion. And he gave me his copy of the Big Book, and he told me to start reading it. And he told me to start from the very front of the book, not at how it works, but at the very front of the book. I was not allowed to share, except for beginners' meetings, in my first 90 days. I wasn't allowed to share at step meetings for steps that I had not experienced. I had to listen to the experience of those who had gone before me, that I might learn a little bit about how to get well. Because they told me this is not group therapy, this is not a talking cure. This is where we recover from alcoholism. And I'm grateful that they did that because, you know, I'd be the guy sitting in the circle and there'd be five people in front of me and I'm thinking about this wonderful thing I'm going to tell everybody. Then I'd share and then I'd miss the 10 people after me because nobody got what I said. So I'm grateful they forced me to listen. And 3 weeks after coming into AA, I was supposed to go away to college and I really wasn't sure whether I should go or not. And, you know, my sponsor told me I had to make my own decision. I asked my mother, and she said, well, if you're willing to go to any lengths, you can stay sober no matter where you are, even in college. And off I went to SUNY Oswego. And, you know, I was the only sober guy on the floor. People were drinking and smoking pot all around me at all times, morning, noon, and night. And I'm staying sober, going to meetings, and, you know, doing okay at school. I'm not knocking them dead. But I turned out to be the dorm DJ because I was the only one who wasn't drunk enough, and I could actually spin the records and have a good time. Ended up having a DJ business for 10 years after that. But I stayed sober, and my sponsor started bringing me through the 12 steps. And over the course of my first year in AA, I went through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous because they told me I had to change the guy I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous, otherwise I was doomed to drink again. No ifs, ands, or buts. And they told me that going to meetings wasn't enough, that if I wanted to get sober, there was a lot more work than just showing up for an hour once a day at a meeting, that there was some positive action that had to take place in order for me to change the guy I brought to AA. And so I went through the 12 steps with Jimmy the Hat, and then we moved from Westchester County down to Long Island and while I was still going to school. And on one of my trips back to Long Island from school, I was brought to a meeting called the Clear School Group, which meets on Sunday mornings. And back then they had a gigantic step meeting where they would have several hundred people at the step meeting and five other meetings that ran at the same time. I was introduced to a guy named Don, And Don brought me to the 12-step shade. And he said, well, what's the 12 steps for? And I was sober a year. I knew everything. So I said, well, to recover from alcoholism. What do you mean? And he says, why don't you read step 12? Why don't you read it slowly out loud? Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. The result of these steps. He says, stop right there. What is the purpose of taking the 12 steps? It is to have a spiritual awakening. It is to change. It is change, 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 just like it tells us in Appendix 2 in our book. The word change shows up there well over a dozen times in its various forms, and that's what I need to do. I had to become Chi-conscious. And, a funny thing happens when you get sober. You start to develop a conscience. You start to live differently. You start to see things differently. And, that man became my sponsor, and he taught me a lot about living. I had to learn how to live. You know, I had no idea how to live when I came to AA. I really did not. And my typical day was to get up at the last possible moment with the last dime in my pocket, with the last ounce of gas in my car, and drive off to work, trying to get there on time, cursing everybody and giving them the finger while I drove down the shoulder of the road. Get to work late. The boss is pissed off at me. I had to borrow money from somebody so I could actually buy some lunch. Serenity was not part of my program at the time. And my sponsor said to me, Don said, why don't you try getting up 15 minutes earlier? Why don't you try not spending every dime on a Friday night while you're going out chasing girls? Why don't you try filling up your car when you get down to a quarter of a tank instead of seeing how far below E you can go? I started doing that, and things got easier. It's funny how you do these little things, and life gets easier. Then he says to me, when you're driving to work, why don't you try turning the radio off for 10 miles? And so there's a great rock and roll station called WBAB on Long Island, which I still listen to this day. And I used to have that blasting all the time. So I said, okay, I'm willing to follow directions. So I turned the radio off, and I watched the odometer, 9.9, 10, boom, turn it back on. Missing out on an opportunity to think about the day ahead. What am I going to face? Maybe I should think a little bit about this. He was trying to teach me how to meditate, and I didn't understand that at all. It took me a long time to get my arms around that. But then I started doing that, and, my life started to work out a little bit easier as time went on. And I'd love to say that ever since then, everything's been wonderful, and I made my first million at 21 and all this other crap, and that's not true. I've had to make a lot of mistakes in sobriety. I got married when I was sober 5 years. I fell victim to the idea that my brains were out of hock, whatever the hell that means at 5 years. Didn't mean much. I ended up being divorced a year later and deeply in debt, living on a cash basis. And by this time, I got my current sponsor, Bill B. And I went to him and I said, what the hell am I doing here? He says, the only answer for you, my friend, is more spiritual growth. And not the answer I was looking for. More spiritual growth. And, that's been the theme for every sponsor I've had and all the people I've looked up to in AA. They have strong spiritual programs. You know, there's a line on page 95 that I like to quote a lot at meetings. And what it says there, it's in Working with Others, and what it says there is that he shouldn't be prodded by you, his wife, or his friends. If he is to find God, the desire must come from within. And that's talking about working with others. It's not saying if he is to find sobriety, it is if he is to find God. And the longer I'm sober, the more I'm convinced that this is a program to find God, and sobriety just happens to come along with it. And it's true. I labored under the delusion that AA was a not drinking club, and it is anything but. It is a way of life that enables us to live and not even think about picking up a drink. And I don't subscribe to the false notion that if I walk out of here tonight, I might slip on a banana peel, fall into the Peppermill Inn, and get drunk. Sobriety is not built that way, at least for me. It's not built that way. It's not this very precarious thing that if I get struck by lightning, I'm going to get drunk. It's just not built that way. To me, sobriety is very robust, so long as I do a few simple things. So long as I'm aligning my will up with that of God's, I stand a real chance at happiness. Early on in sobriety, I was introduced to a book called The Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox. And I read the book early on and cast it aside. I didn't get a lot out of it. But in later years, I picked it up, and it speaks a lot about what we practice here in Alcoholics Anonymous. It talks about the discipline of the mind and recognizing where our place is in this world. And, you know, as I started to research a little bit, I found out some very interesting things about it. That it was written the year that Bill got sober. It was written in 1934. And Emmett Fox was a guy who preached in New York to tens of thousands of people. He was very popular back in the 30s. And it also turns out that Bill Wilson sponsored Emmett Fox's secretary's son, a guy named Bob Steckman. And the early AAs used to go hear Emmett Fox speak regularly. So when you read the Sermon on the Mount and the Big Book side by side, you start to find that there's an awful lot of stuff in both of those books, and it's not by mistake. It really isn't. And, so I use the Sermon on the Mount as one of the books that I use with people that I sponsor. Because we're told that we are to grow in understanding and effectiveness. And I'm not fenced in by conference-approved literature. There's other stuff that we're encouraged in the Big Book to pick up. And I'm not afraid to do that. That's why I can say I'm a satisfied customer of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that doesn't mean that, you know, I go to meetings all over the place and speak and everything's wonderful. It means I can actually enjoy the work that I do. Now, the work I do isn't something that I had chosen for myself. I'm the director of operations for a large mall in Prams, New Jersey. I would never go to a mall in my life. It just happens that I work for a mall developer, so I'm there, you know, and they pay me well. And it'd be easy for me to say I'm not doing something that's vital or of use to the human race, but I can take what I have here and bring it out there. Now, one of the favorite stories I like to tell, and Brian reminded me over dinner about this particular story, I'm responsible for all the construction at the mall. And, you know, when you do construction, it annoys the crap out of people. There's no two ways about it. And so we had to pave a parking lot around the Nordstrom store. The Nordstrom people are the most difficult tenants you can have. So whenever there was a meeting with this regional manager from Nordstrom, my boss would hide under his desk, and I was stuck dealing with this woman. And so I placed myself in her shoes and thought, what does she really want? She wants to know what the hell's going on so she could tell her bosses what's happening. So I ran this project. I gave her these daily work updates. I met with her every week. I mean, you know, I buttered her bread the best I could. And the job came off great. We came in. We were a little bit late, but we had this water main to change out. So, I mean, to me, it was this great success. She demanded a meeting with me at the end of the project. I'm not happy with what's gone on here. So I sit in the meeting, my boss finds something else to do, and I get to sit with this woman named Serene. And she was anything but serene. And she starts going up one side of me and down the other. And there was a little part of me that said, you know, I've run hundreds of millions of dollars worth of construction. Don't you know who you're talking to? Now, that's inside my head. What came out of my mouth was, you're right. I could have done better. I apologize. And that stopped the meeting in its tracks. She was looking for a fight, and I didn't give her one. It was very easy to resist not evil and not get into the ditch with her. And she walked away happy. Everything worked out just fine, you know, all because of stuff I've learned here. You know, what does AA have to do with property management or whatever? Has everything to do with it. Everything to do with it. I get to have good relationships with just about everybody. And I get to diffuse situations that can be incendiary very quickly. It's okay for me to be wrong. I don't have any kind of personal stake in it, and it's okay. It's okay. My ego gets subtracted out of the equation. But more importantly, the word fear is no longer a gigantic part of my life. And people say, oh, you must have some kind of fear. And you know, when I get laid off from a job and it drives my wife crazy, I fall right to sleep that night. I'm not circling the wagons and selling off real estate and all this other stuff. I fall right back to sleep because I know God's going to take care of me. Every single time, He has taken care of me. But the alcoholic human part of me says, well, He's not going to do it this time. But He does. He comes through every single time. He's the pinch hitter you want to have because He gets a hit every time. And so I need to subtract fear out of the equation. My dad, who's retired down in Sarasota, Florida, retired very well off. He worked for IBM for many, many years. And he's the epitome of the retired businessman lolling in the Florida sunshine in the wintertime, complaining about the sad state of affairs. He is that man personified. Now, he was an economist, and he's been retired for 20 years. I sit there, and I can give him about 3 days, all right? Because 3 days of the Chinese have to keep buying our T-bills, otherwise our economy's going down the crapper is about all I can take. And here's a man who has everything. He has good health. He has a loving wife. He lives in a beautiful home on a lake. He has a wonderful family. And that's what he has to do, is complain about that. And he pushes everybody away. So after 3 days, I go to my sister's just for some insanity. But he's a big movie buff. And, you know, so he likes to talk about movies from the 40s and stuff. There's one movie that I like a lot. I was telling this story to a new sponsor yesterday. It's the movie Jaws. Has anybody seen Jaws here? Right? Now, Jaws is a movie a lot of people are familiar with, and the idea of a shark is scary to just about everybody. It's the epitome of fear. It really personifies it. And when you look at every one of the characters in the movie Jaws, they personify a different face of fear. You know, you take the Mayor Vaughn. Now, here's a guy who figures if you ignore it, it's going to go away while the whole town's going down the crapper. Then you have the oceanographer, Matt Hooper. And Hooper thinks if he understands everything about the shark that he can vanquish the fear. Well, he almost gets killed, too, in the movie. You have Chief Brody's wife, who moved from New York to this little town and is dying to run away. And even that scene on the wharf where Captain Quint is singing sea shanties and she's running out is exactly it, running away from fear. Captain Quint thinks he can kill every shark on the face of the earth, and that way he will vanquish his fear. The only guy who really faces his fear is Chief Brody, a man who is afraid of the water, goes out on a boat to go kill a shark, and does. And what that tells me is that the fear will come up in my life in many different ways. And I might try to remove the fear itself, but I'm missing the point. The point is that I need to not give place in my life of fear to live. And what I mean is that in the spiritual economy, in the spiritual world, you don't actually remove something, but you displace it. Just like you take a glass of vegetable oil that's half full, and you pour water in it. If you pour enough water in, it displaces the vegetable oil, and then you have a glass of water. If I displace that fear with faith, I don't have to worry about fear anymore. It gets displaced, and it's true with our defects of character, just the same way. How many of you have tried to work on a defect of character, and it only comes back stronger? I think everybody in this room has had that experience to one degree or another, because fear is the prime motivator of our defects. What we need to do is take away the prime motivation for that fear. We need to add faith. We need to have a relationship with God. The most important fact of my existence today is my relationship with God. And God's crazy about me. Yep. So God's crazy about me, and that's all there is to it. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm in a position where I get to carry a vital message. I get to sponsor quite a few people. I get to help them to work through the spiritual journey, there's nothing better. And so what if I manage a mall in New Jersey? It really doesn't matter. It's a means to allow me to do all the other stuff. And I get plenty of opportunities to carry this message. I've been able to, you know, go to Europe and run big book studies and speak at the EuriPod conference there. People latch on to this stuff. I don't know why. I really don't know why. But hopefully that I have a demonstration, another word that shows up in our big book many, many times, but a demonstration of sobriety in action. And to me, sobriety is not a not drinking club. It's a way of life that's infinitely satisfying. Thanks.